Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Wild Hour and Editorial Review. The Wild Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Wild Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Wild Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Plowman's Folly when we come back. Are you concerned about your privacy? Well, how much does your government know about you, and how much do you want your government to know about you? Well, government only knows as much about you as you tell them about yourself. Everything that government, industry, or business knows about you is because you told them. Now, the Fourth Amendment protects you in your person, houses, papers, and effects, but it doesn't protect you from yourself. Now, can we have privacy in the computer age? Well, you bet we can. Information is gathered and stored about you in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. It's knowing how much information is gathered, what information is stored, and what information you want to keep personal and private. That's what actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. So always keep in mind that no one knows anything about you that you haven't revealed by your own hand or by your own mouth. Now, if you'd like to learn more about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call and ask for our free general law CD package? That's a four-hour program. It's interesting, it's entertaining, it's informative, it's educational. Best of all, it's free. Why don't you just call the school at area code 417-273-4967 and ask for your free copy. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Plowman's Folly, a book written back in 1943, is a follow-up to our earlier story on the aquifers are going dry. Why are the aquifers going dry? Well, because we're irrigating. Why are we irrigating? Well, because we need more soil moisture. Well, why don't we have more soil moisture? And the answer is because we plow. An implement, a farming implement, discovered by a fellow named John Deere back in 1827. Everybody uses one. If you're a farmer and you don't plow, there's something wrong with you. But is there any scientific reason for plowing? I know we all do it. Now let's take a look at why do we do it and how did we get started? Well, briefly, the book sets out to show that the moldboard plow, which is in use on farms throughout the civilized world, is the least satisfactory implement for the preparation of land for the production of crops. Now, that may sound like a paradox, and perhaps in view of the fact that for nearly a century there's been a science of agriculture, and that agricultural scientists, almost to a man, have used and approved the use of the moldboard plow. Nevertheless, the statement made above is true, and it's capable of proof, and much of the proof, as a matter of fact, has come in left-handed manner from scientists themselves. The truth of the matter is that no one has ever advanced a scientific reason for plowing. And many learned teachers have had embarrassing moments before classes of students, asking to be shown why it would not be better to introduce all organic matter into the surface of the soil than it is to bury it, as is done by the plow. Now, the entire body of reasoning about the management of the soil has been based upon this axiomatic assumption of the correctness of plowing. But plowing is not correct. Hence, the main premise being untenable, we may rightly question the validity of every popularly accepted theory concerning and concerned with the production of any crop when the land has been plowed in preparation for its growth. So that brings virtually all of our soil theories up for critical examination. So in this book, the whole gamut of the theory that we have evolved concerning the growing of crops needs to be brought into focus for examination in the light of the discovery that plowing is a bad practice. This discussion will be undertaken in language common to every layman, so far as this is possible, and throughout the text footnotes will be introduced to explain whatever may be perhaps out of the range of the thinking of the average man on the street. The nature of the reasoning upon which this entire study is based makes it unnecessary to resort to any but the simplest of scientific terms. Moreover, there are few ideas which are not common knowledge, strange as that may seem. The vast amount of technical language created by scientific agriculture as a result of an early and fundamental mistake has produced its own confusion, and indeed the mistake originally made might justly be called the basis for most, if not all, of the technology connected with present-day agronomy. An agricultural experiment station has its uses, but these uses obviously would not have embraced the problem presented in this book if those who actually work the soil had not got off to a false start in this matter of plowing in the first place. So in brief, if a way had been found to mix into the surface of the soil everything that the farmer now plows under the soil, if the implements used in planting and cultivating the crop had been designated and designed to operate in the trashy surface that would have resulted from mixing rough straw, leaves, stalks, stubble, weeds, and briars into the surface, crop production would have been so automatic, so spontaneous, that there might not have developed what we now know as agricultural science. Actually, we would scarcely have needed agricultural science. From one point of view, we have been creating our own soil problems merely for the doubtful pleasure of solving these problems. Had we not originally gone contrary to the laws of nature by plowing the land in the first place, we would have avoided the problems as well as the expensive and time-consuming efforts that it now takes to solve these soil problems. That we would also have missed all of the erosion, the sour soils, mounting floods, the lowering of our water tables, the vanishing wildlife, the compact and impervious soil surfaces is scarcely an incidental consideration. And we have really had a fling at scientific agriculture, and the fling, in fact, appears to be the scientific counterpart of what our grandfathers used to call sowing wild oats. Now it's time to sober up and to begin to apply to the growing of farm crops the same basic common sense that we have for so long been using in our factories, mills, and workshops of our reasonably progressive civilization. We have equipped our farmers with a greater tonnage of machinery per man than any other nation on planet Earth. Our agricultural population has proceeded to use that machinery to the end of destroying the soil in less time than any other nation or race of people in the history of the world. And this is hardly a record to be proud of. It gains nothing in attractiveness. And moreover, when we consider that the Chinese and the often despised peasantry of the so-called backward countries of the world can produce more food per acre without machinery than can the American farmer with all of his fine equipment and thousands of gallons of diesel fuel, and any reasonably well-traveled person will confirm that statement. Now, one of the persistent puzzles has been the fact that an ignorant, poverty-stricken Egyptian who stirs his land with an ancient crooked stick can produce more food per acre than his British neighbor whose equipment is right up to the minute. Now, the explanation is that the poor farmer cannot afford the equipment that would make it impossible for him to continue growing such high yields per acre. And the full import of all of this will be explained in due process. Now, there is double meaning in the statement that all of the trouble in producing crops seems to lie in the farmer's fields. And that's because the uncultivated fields and the woodlands that are surrounding all of this land don't show any signs of trouble whatsoever. Even the crops growing in the fence rows seem to thrive through droughts as well as in fine weather. Thistles don't have any problem growing in the fence rows, do they? Now, would that observation justify us then in wondering whether the manner in which farmers handle their land might actually be responsible for the way crops grow under tillage? Certainly, we should not overlook the possibility that a clue to the farmer's trouble might be found by a comparative study of cultivated and virgin soils. Our conventional ideas of growing processes are due for drastic revision. Much thought and experimental work have been devoted to studies of plant growth, but there has been comparatively little consideration of the part played in plant and animal growth by the actual transfer, more or less, directly or indirectly, of previously used plant food from a lifeless body to one that is living, for instance, the dead plants from last fall. We often think and speak of growth as if it were a building process, which indeed it is. But we are likely to assume without sufficient thought that the best growth would result from the use of materials not previously used in organic tissues. So we think of our farm crops as getting a mineral solution from the soil. And we think of that solution as originating from soil minerals directly or from fertilizers that the farmer applies out of bags that he unloads off of a truck. So we don't give very much consideration to the biochemistry of organic matter. And we know that anything covered up in the soil is subject to rather prompt decay, if it is at all decayable. But we do not reason from that point to acceptance of the decay products as choice building material for the growing of crops in the immediate vicinity. In our material civilization, we have rightly learned to be suspicious of anything constructed of cast-off materials. Very few people would buy an automobile that was assembled from used parts. And a suit of clothes made of shoddy material would not bring a very high price. So our basic distrust carries over into our thinking about the materials that are essential to the development of a new plant. This wouldn't be true if we did some critical thinking on the subject, but we have not done any critical thinking on the subject of agronomy, at least not in this century. We have left the whole subject to our scientific men, the men at Monsanto, and they have learned the facts, and in many instances they have published their findings in books or pamphlets, which anyone who cares to do so may read. But very few have cared to wade through the technical language in which these studies usually have been expressed. Such writings seldom make the headlines or the front pages, so we never bother to read them, and this may be distinctly bad for us. Much of our knowledge of nutritive relationship in plants is what might be called academic, something that we learned in college, pigeonholed after discovery and never developed into practical usefulness. Particularly is this true of our knowledge concerning plant nutrition. We know, of course, that no animal can subsist solely on mineral solutions in simple inorganic form. So we don't take our lime as lime water or our iron as tincture, at least not to any great extent as a matter of nutrition. Our present knowledge indicates that the human race and the whole animal kingdom would disappear completely from planet Earth if deprived of that organic storehouse known as the plant kingdom. So that being true, it is highly important, then, that we have a thoroughly practical understanding of the nutritive relationships between plants and the soil, for those relationships are necessary, fundamental, to animal well-being, including, of course, the human race. Now, it's for purposes of this discussion that we will simply simplify our reasoning if we think of inorganic solutions, such as those that occur in soil, where water is in contact with mineral crystals as new or primary plant foods. And the inorganic solutions that originate in the decay of plant or animal tissues as used or second-hand plant foods. Now, these are distinctly not the technician's terms for such concepts, but it will be shown herein that they are useful for the layman in understanding how plants may be made to grow best. And it should be said also that in practice we would almost never find in the soil any organic solution entirely devoid of inorganic compounds. And this is because the water, which assists in the decay of organic tissues, already carries a load of inorganic compounds when it is absorbed into the organic material. Now, the chief trouble with our farming is that we have concerned ourselves increasingly with the difficult techniques of supplying our farm crops with new materials for growth, when we could easily take full advantage of the almost automatic provisions of nature for supplying plants with complete rations of second-hand form, and we have made a difficult job of what should be a very easy one. Now, several circumstances have conspired to distort our point of view on the nutrition of plants. About 30 years ago, the farmers had not become so familiar as they are now with the possibilities offered by these inorganic commercial fertilizers. But as they have learned about these inorganic commercial fertilizers, and as the costs of such fertilizers have been reduced from time to time, it has been progressively easier to use these mineral fertilizers. Meanwhile, the means of restoring organic matter back into the soil has seemed at the same time to become progressively more difficult. So the net result is that technical attention to the inorganic mineral supply has been more and more necessary, and the organic possibilities have simply vanished from consideration. Now, the last few paragraphs outline the basic nutritive concepts involved in this book. No new technical discoveries are to be aired here. This discussion is concerned wholly with reducing to practical terms, employable in anybody's backyard or on any farm anywhere in the world, the scientific information possessed for decades, but up till now, it has not been put into any extensive use. Now, green manures have been known and they have been recommended for decades. For those to whom the idea may be new, green manures are simply crops of any kind grown for use as decayable material in the soil where it's grown. Farmers have been advised for years to make frequent and regular use of green manures to supplement the always inadequate supply of animal manure. In keeping with this idea, county agents as early as 30 years ago urged farmers to make the plowing down of green manures the basis of their soil improvement program for very thin land. Then, when the results of those early attempts were reported, trouble loomed. Plowing down great masses of green manure proved such a colossal failure that subsequent attempts to improve growing conditions for plants have been cautious expedients rather than bold attempts to imitate the perfect example that we see set by the natural landscape out in the forest, for instance. It seems never to have occurred to anybody to question the effects of the universally approved process of plowing down these crops with the moldboard plow. Now, the prevalent and generally accepted doctrine concerning green manures has accordingly been modified to two comparatively ineffective recommendations. That is, first, plow down the green manure crop early, before it has become woody and difficult to rot. And two, if the crop gets out of hand and becomes woody before it can be plowed in, apply nitrogen fertilizers to the crop itself before plowing it down. Now, even these two recommendations have always been recognized as makeshift procedures, and it's only too obvious that tender rye or other green crops must contain less minerals than the same plants would contain if those same plants had been allowed to reach their full growth. And while the second recommendation is of more recent origin and is supposed to be more advantageous, it has a fundamental weakness for which there is no completely effective remedy in nature. That is, the purpose of adding the nitrogen fertilizer is to hasten the decomposition of the biomass, thus removing the organic matter as a bar to further rise in the soil of water from deep in the earth. And it should be mentioned here that the plowing in of great quantities of absorbent material results in exhausting the water supply from the overlying soil layers. This decay, then, is hastened by this trick, but the decay products released are necessarily subject to being leached out of the soil by the first rains that fall after their release. So a relatively small percentage of these nutrients can be retained by the colloids in the soils which have enough colloids that are not hardly or already holding all of the plant nutrients in the first place. The rest must inevitably be lost unless, by lucky chance, we suffer from drought, insufficient rain falls to carry them away before roots arrive to salvage them. And it must be remembered, too, that in most soils, very few roots ever reach the plow sole to do salvage work. So the net effect, then, of this treatment is likely to be zero. Likely, it will be shown that such use of nitrogen, any purchased nitrogen, in fact, is a total waste of your money, since nature is perfectly organized to supply the correct amount of nitrogen to every plant. Later, too, the universal use in nature of the principle of direct transfer of organic compounds from the decaying dead plants to the growing living plants will be exemplified by illustrations from small-scale test work supplemented by later field work done during the past decade in a city backyard and on leased land out in the country. Most scientists probably are mentally unprepared to accept, without official tests, an idea apparently so new. An exception is Paul B. Sears, who, in his book, Deserts on the March, has pictured plant nutrition as follows. He said, "The face of the earth is a graveyard, and so it has always been. To earth each living thing restores when it dies that which has been borrowed to give form and substance to its brief day in the sun. It's from the earth in due course that each new living being receives back again alone of that which sustains life. What is lent by earth has been used by countless generations of plants and animals now dead and will be required by countless others in the future. No plant or animal, nor any other sort, can establish permanent right of possession to the materials which compose its physical body." Thus, pointedly, Sears brings to our attention a vital principle of plant growth which has not hitherto been sufficiently utilized. Though most scientists have been aware of its academic existence, at least, he says by implication that life necessarily depends upon the snuffing out of other lives of enormous populations. In fact, we dislike thinking of ourselves as murderous, but the fact that we must be, if we are to live, is difficult to refute. You see, as civilized beings, we keep the slaughterhouse out of sight of the dining room. But unless we are vegetarians, our very existence depends upon keeping that slaughterhouse busy. Even the strictest vegetarian must snuff out many lives, the lives of plants, if he is to retain his own life. Now, such suggestions may sound like bits of philosophical quibbling. However, the ideas involved are so pertinent to the subject at hand that they need to be brought sharply into focus in our thinking. Now, we've always accepted theoretically the interdependence of every form of life upon every other form of life, and we have not so easily progressed to the thought that dead tissues contribute their substance to new living forms. This is, however, the solemn, necessary truth. And the earlier that this truth becomes a part of our thinking, then the more quickly we can plan intelligently the necessary work of recreating our soils on our farms and farmlands. And we've been too squeamish to visualize dead tissue being transformed into new living tissue, though with every mouthful we eat to demonstrate precisely that fact. So let us be practical, even if being so practical proves painful to our stomachs. Plants establish intakes in the form of roots for nutritive materials in the decaying fragments of last year's plants. And when they're left to themselves, they will use without loss every atom of the material that previously had been used in the dead plants from last year and the years before. So as farmers, we have not left the bodies of last year's plants where the roots of this season's plants could invade them. Instead, we have buried those decaying remains so deep that very few roots could reach them. You see, we have, by plowing, made it impossible for our farm crops to do their best. Obviously, it seems that the time has arrived for us to look into our methods of soil preparation and soil management with a view to copying the surface situation that we find out in the forests and prairies, where the plow has not disturbed the soil. No crime is involved in plagiarizing nature's ways, discovering the underlying principles involved in carrying them over for use on cultivated land. It violates no patents. It violates no copyrights. In fact, all that is necessary to do if we want better agriculture is to recharge the soil surface with materials that will rot. Natural processes will do the rest. The plant kingdom is organized to clothe the earth with greenery, and wherever man does not disturb it, the entire surface usually is well covered. The task of this book is to show that our soil problems have been, to a considerable extent, psychological, that except for our sabotage of nature's design for growth, in reality, there is actually no soil problems that we have not created all by ourselves. Well, with that introduction, boys and girls, let's take a look here at our mid-break reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour and editorial review. Remember, we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log, schedule, and archives. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, history, health, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, simply call the Law School and ask for it at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. 4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, where you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Reviewing the book, Plowman's Folly, written by Edward H. Faulkner. Spelled F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R, an agricultural scientist who wrote the book back in World War II, published in 1943. I first saw this book in high school ag class. I asked my ag teacher about it, and I took the book out of the library and read it. Then I came back and I said, well, why are we plowing them? He didn't know. He said it was custom, it was habit, it's been around for a long time. So I decided to look into it. I wanted to know more. I mean, after all, if this guy Faulkner is correct, and if we're destroying soil fertility by plowing, common sense would say, well, we ought to stop doing it. The destruction of soil fertility by the tillage methods opens the door for multinational corporations to sell commercial chemical fertilizers. I mean, if you can't produce on your land, you got to do something. So the chemical man comes along and says, well, gosh, if you put this chemical fertilizer on, it'll solve your problem. And it does. It does. There's no problems with a commercial man selling commercial fertilizer to the farming man who's in commercial agriculture. It just works like a symbiotic process, a pilot fish in a shark's mouth, cleaning his teeth. Now, of course, for the consumer, it doesn't work so well. Because here's the bottom line. The farmer goes to commercial man sells him the fertilizer. These are the chemical byproducts of the petrochemical industry. He puts it on the soil, and great, wondrous, lush growth of corn and soybeans and other plants develops. I mean, lush growth. So in the process of this lush growth over here, we develop insects, and that's because the nutrient content of the plants is lacking. And the insects attack plants that have nutritive deficiencies. It was designed that way by God, and it's designed that way to protect you. Works like a shot. For instance, have you ever gone out, picked up an apple off the ground, bit into it, and found half a worm? Makes you kind of disgusted, sick, so you throw the apple on the ground and spit it out, and you feel real bad. And then you want to go drink water and wash your mouth out. all over a little green worm running around inside the apple. For some reason, it's very distasteful. But why is that worm in that apple and he's not in the other apples? In fact, the worms don't attack every apple. And most people look at that and say, well, that's because there's not enough worms. If there was more worms, they would have attacked every apple. But we find that that's not the case. They attack some of the apples, but not all the apples. And the bottom line is that the apple, when you test it, you find that it's got some nutritive deficiencies that the apples that don't have worms in them don't have. So when God designed this process, he said, well, I need to protect people from nutritive deficiencies. So what I'll do is I'll invent these insects, and I'll put these worms out here who will consume, who will destroy, who will make unappetizing these apples that have these nutritive deficiencies. So we don't eat those. So if you're a farmer like I am and you look at these apples with all these worms in it, you say to commercial man, well, look at all of the agricultural losses I'm suffering. You know, about 10% or 20 or 30% of my crop is being eaten up by these worms, and I don't know why. So commercial man doesn't go out and say, well, gosh, if you'd put more organic material in the soil so that the tree would have more dead bodies to eat, so it would have more nutritives to put into the apples, then the worms wouldn't eat them. Commercial man says there's no money in that. So he goes out and he develops some kind of a spray like DDT. He tests it on these worms and it kills them. That's because it's a dirty, deadly, toxic poison. So commercial man says to the farmer man, he says, look, if you would spray this spray on your crops, it'll kill the worms. So farmer man buys the spray from commercial man, sprays his crop, and Viola kills all the worms, which is precisely what the farmer wants. So the farmer doesn't say, gee, I need to put more nutritives in the soil for the tree so that the tree can produce apples that are full of nutrients. Farmers don't get paid for nutrients. Farmers get paid for bushels of apples. Corn farmers get paid for bushels of corn, not nutrients. Nobody tests the nutritive content of the plants, of the fruits, of the vegetables. We weigh the finished product. So what happens is this apple is lacking in copper, zinc, or iron, or some other nutritive, but it doesn't make any difference because the worm can't eat it because the worm is dead. So now you buy the apple and you take it home and you eat it. And so you eat the poison residue, which builds up in the fat of your body. So you're being poisoned by the DDT or the chemical pesticide. At the same time, you're eating this apple, which is nutritively deficient. Later, you develop cancer. You get pains, and so you go to the hospital. You want to cut out your liver or your lungs or your heart or something else and give you a new one from somebody else, for which you need health insurance to pay for this medical service from medical commercial man. So you got commercial man over here selling you chemical fertilizers, commercial man selling you commercial pesticides, commercial agriculture selling you deficient apples and deficient fruits and vegetables, for which you eat them. Your body then is deficient in nutritives. And so then you get sick, and so therefore you have to have health insurance. Can't you see how this develops into a robust, stable economy? And along comes this nitwit Faulkner over here trying to upset the apple cart and telling you, well, why don't you start with soil nutrition to start with so that you can have plants that have nutrition in the plant, so that when you eat the fruit, you can have nutrition in your body, which then will give you healthy, strong bodies for which you won't get sick, for which you won't have pain, for which you won't need to go to the hospital, for which you don't need to buy insurance. Do you want the insurance industry to go bankrupt? Do you want the petrochemical industry to lay off workers? Aren't you kinder? Aren't you gentler? Aren't you concerned about the health, safety, the welfare of the economy? Getting back to Faulkner, he says, science now knows that several times more plant food is carried away from farmland in the streams that drain the various watersheds than is being absorbed by the growing crops or grazed off by the animals. And most of this loss is in visible form, that is, it's dissolved. It's an especially important consideration because it's in the only form in which plants are able to take in their food. The undissolved, that is the visible, eroded portion of the loss makes the news simply because it's visible. You can see the mud in the muddy stream. But that's relatively unimportant as a law, since beneath that mud, where it lay, there is an inexhaustible stock of the same material. The chief damage that's being done by erosion, boys and girls, is the filling in of stream channels, reservoirs, and natural lakes, along with the burial of downstream lands under a very inert layer of miscellaneous mud. Fortunately, the necessary technique for preventing this erosion is precisely what is required to make the land most productive, and that is to restore the conditions which prevailed upon the land when it was new, when it was in its virgin state. And then we will cure all of this erosion and restore productiveness at the same stroke. Now, for years, scientific men have been aware that losses by leaching were in progress. But until the reports of the National Resources Board was made in 1934, very few people had any conception of the staggering scale on which our mineral resources were going out to sea. To arouse general interest in this matter, the U.S. Department of Agriculture included on page 99 of its 1938 yearbook a condensed table of the various kinds of losses. So to clarify further the seriousness of our land waste, the department hired Russell Lord, an able agricultural writer, to advertise the government's efforts to stop erosion by cooperative watershed demonstrations in various locations around the country. And in his report, Mr. Lord gives this concrete resume of the figures in the report of the National Resources Board. So he said, leached plant food is that part that percolates down through the soil and is lost by way of underground waters. Of mineral losses such as nitrogen, phosphorus, potash, calcium, magnesium, and sulfur, crops and grazing take off a total of 19,500,000 tons a year, while erosion and leaching whisk away nearly 120 million tons a year, about six times more. And incidentally, Mr. Lord became so impressed by the urgency of the situation reflected above that he wrote Behold Our Land, in which he presented further interesting material and published it the same year. Now remember, boys and girls, this report was made back in 1938. Nothing has changed, except that we have now learned how to destroy our land even faster. Now, we were losing the soil nutrition at the rate of 120 million tons a year. Let's just try that down. 120, and that was in 1938. So that was about 68 years ago, times 68. That's 8,160. Okay. So we're talking about 8,160 million, or about 8,160,000,000,000, or excuse me, 117 million, that's a tenth of a billion. Now, it's 8,160,000,000 tons in my lifetime. That's what's been lost by erosion. Now, you know, that's like mining a coal seam. When we arrived here with Columbus in 1492, all of the soil nutrients and soil nutrition that was available was in the ground. Now, from the days of Columbus until today, we've been using up that nutrition in the soil. You know, the tons of these items like nitrogen, phosphorus, potash, calcium, magnesium, sulfur. We've been using that up. We've been mining it out of the soil. For every ton that we took out, we threw away six. So it takes about seven tons to produce out of the soil what we consume. Now, it would just seem logical to me that we could last here about seven times longer if we didn't waste six tons out of every seven. It's just a thought. It's a wild new concept. I mean, it would be like sitting down at the dinner table, you know, and you put seven spoonfuls of peas on your plate. You eat one and then dump the rest out to the dog. You reach over and then you take a steak and then you cut off one piece and you eat it and you throw the rest of the steak out to the dog. I mean, that somehow to me seems to be a little bit wasteful, but evidently that's the way we do things here in America. Now, incidentally, Mr. Lord became so impressed by the urgency of the situation, he wrote a book called Behold Our Land, in which he presented further interesting material and published it that same year, 1938. So if you'd like a copy of the book, the guy's name is Lord, L-O-R-D. The title of the book is Behold Our Land. And you can do the same thing here with Plowman's Folly. I probably have about five copies of this Plowman's Folly. Every time I see one in the store, I buy it. You know, some people look up there on my shelf and they say, why do you buy that book? I buy it because it's rare. It's valuable and it's rare. And someday, somebody out there in Radio Land may say, gosh, I need a copy of that book. So if you do, what you do is you go to your local bookstore, you know, the used bookstore, and then you tell the guy, I'd like a copy of Plowman's Folly by Edward H. Faulkner, F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R. And they'll plug that into their computer, and they may find a copy of it in San Luis Obispo, California, or they may find it in Eureka, California, or Salem, Oregon, you know, or Portland, Maine. One time I got a book out of some town in South Africa. So they're tied in, and in fact, many of them around the world, so that the book inventory. And this guy, Faulkner, he probably made, I don't know, 10, 20, 30,000 of these books back in 1943. And, you know, if 10% of them are still available out there, don't worry about any farmers being interested in this. They're not. Those are chemical, agricultural people. They're not interested in Plowman's Folly. So you can rest assured that there's plenty of copies out there for the 5 or 10 of you who might be interested in this. The 5 or 10 of you that are concerned about drought and famine, concerned about being able to feed your families over the next 10 or 20 years. So I'm one of those, and so I needed a copy of the book so that I could understand why it was that my plowing practices were destroying my land so that I could stop doing it. I don't plow here. I haven't for many years. I can remember as a kid, though. I remember the very first job I had with Frank Rocha that spring. It was the spring of 56. We were out there farming like crazy. Now, he had a John Deere D tractor with iron wheels. God, I was at the height of my career, 15 years old, standing up on top of that tractor, watching the soil turn turtle, and two 16-inch John Deere bottom plows. It took 3 weeks to plow 20 acres with a whole John Deere. Well, it took 3 weeks to plow it and farm it up. I shouldn't say to plow it. We plowed in about a week, but then you got to go back and disc it and prepare the soil. You don't want to go seed it. Yeah, I was one of those guys that was out there busily destroying the land just as fast as I could. Well, that's what you learn in ag school. And we learn about chemicals, and we learn how to destroy the land. Now, this guy Faulkner comes along and says, well, listen, it's a wild new concept, but there's no drought out in the forest, and there's no drought out in the prairie. The drought is over here on the farmland. What's happening? And why is it happening that way? And why can an Egyptian with a crooked stick produce more per acre than Joe Farmer in Illinois that has 600 horsepower at his disposal? That's right, boys and girls. The average American farmer has 600 horsepower at his disposal. And if you take a look at the product, the production per acre, America, out of 180 countries in the world or so, ranks 32nd. And the Egyptians rank first. And then there's 30 other countries in the world that produce more per acre than we Americans. We like to think of ourselves as being very productive. And per farmer, we are. We have fewer farmers than we have convicts in prison. I mean, our jail population is greater than our farm population, and we produce more per farmer than anybody else in the world with our 600 horsepower. You take diesel away from the American farmer, and he'd starve to death. In fact, we Americans burn more BTUs preparing the soil for our crops than the BTUs that we harvest in the fall. If we lost our petrochemical resource base, we would starve to death in this country. We couldn't produce crops. The only survivors would be the Amish and Mennonites. The only survivors. Wild idea, isn't it? Now, most of the dissolved plant food that escapes down the streams originates from the decaying material that's been plowed in. Now, this seems an inescapable conclusion from the known facts. And this being true, by salvaging this waste, even though no other measures were taken for any soil improvement whatsoever, we should be able to realize greatly increased production from the land. So long as plant food continues to get away, both land and people become poorer and poorer, and people become more and more subject to ailments, which we now know are caused by insufficiency of some essential vitamin or mineral in their diets. And this book is written in 1943. Now, boys and girls, doctors who go to universities don't know that. That's right. Your doctor never recommends to you, oh my God, you need to eat more spinach. You got an iron deficiency. He gives you a prescription. Now, eating spinach isn't going to make the doctor any money, but selling you a vitamin supplement would, or a drug. So let's be intelligent people. You know, doctors are businessmen, and they're there to sell their products. And fertilizer salesmen are businessmen, and they're there to sell their products. Pesticide and commercial men are businessmen. They're there to sell the products. And farmers are businessmen, and they're there to sell their products. It's just nothing personal. No, just business. And nobody's in the business of selling nutrients. We're in the business of selling fertilizer, pesticides, and bushels and bins of corn, wheat, and soybeans. We don't get paid for the nutritive value of our corn, beans, and soybeans. We get paid for the bushels. And that's what we sell. That's what we produce. Now, the drain tile and the moldboard plow, therefore, become suspect of complicity in robbing our people of their birthright of vigorous health by stealing away vital elements from the plow sole before plant roots are able to salvage them. So logical does this inference seem that it is difficult to understand why it's never been investigated officially. Jesus. This guy Faulkner is really naive, isn't he? God. Why would we want to investigate something that has a dead-end road and has no profit in it? And how in the hell is that going to help us sell chemical fertilizer? How is that going to help us sell pesticide? You know, let's be intelligent people. It's kind of like war. You know, there's more money in war than there is peace. How in the hell are you going to sell F-16s that don't get shot down every once in a while? Or can't be upgraded into something else, you know, that we can sell to the military? Now, wars tear everything up and they have to be rebuilt. Look at Iraq. You know, you go over there and you spend $50 billion and blow the place up, and then you spend, you know, $200, $300, $400, $500 billion rebuilding it. It's like a little kid, you know, playing on the living room floor. He builds all of his blocks and he gets these blocks up, and God, they're just really high. And he's used up all of his blocks, and he doesn't have any more blocks. He's got 50 blocks. He's got them all built up, and he's got this real neat monument. So he comes over and he goes, pow, pow. He knocks them all down all over the living room floor. He just has a great time just blowing it up and pretending that he's destroying it all. Now he's got his blocks scattered all over the floor. Now he can rebuild it again. See how that works? Can't you remember when you were a kid? So when we get to be big kids, we create Teledyne and all these Boeing aircraft companies, you know, and then we build all of these tanks and guns and the thing, and then we go out and we blow everything up, and we can go out and rebuild it again. You know, it would seem like to me that that it costs a lot of money, takes a lot of time, effort, and energy to go out here and rebuild all this stuff. Seems like to me it'd be better if we saved it and spent our energy doing something more constructive. But, you know, we Americans don't have anything more constructive to do than to blow up Iraq and then rebuild it, I guess. So Faulkner says that he finds it a bit humorous, too, to suggest a need for investigating whether men could grow healthy crops if they copy the soil conditions which prevail in nature, where crops are universally healthy. Crops are universally healthy out in nature. Hey, did you notice that down in the Amazon jungle, they got plenty of growth, plenty of trees down there, nobody's plowing, nobody's farming, nobody's fertilizing, nobody's doing jack squat, and the damn thing just grows for thousands of years? You ever notice that? They don't have any commercial men down there in the Amazon basin selling commercial fertilizer to the Brazilian government saying, hey, let me show you how to make the Amazon jungle grow more lush. Now we're down there cutting 4,000 square miles, reducing the rainfall from 120 inches a year in 1957 to 90 inches a year today. We have depreciated the rainfall in the Amazon basin by 25% over the last 50 years. Isn't that just real special? Hey, let's get after it. We're not destroying things fast enough. All right, we're talking about Plowman's Folly. We'll be back next time. Take it up right there. I'm about out of time, so I'm going to have to leave it right there. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. All of these law hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tonight, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.